Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hi, and welcome to Your Family Dog. I'm Julie Fudge-Smith, and I'm here, of course, with Colleen Pilar. And today we have a special guest, Dr. Michael Morales. He is a professor at the University of Buffalo Medical School. He got his BA from Kalamazoo College, his PhD from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas. He did postdoctorate fellowships at the University of Washington in St. Louis and at Duke University. And now he is the research assistant professor of physiology and biophysics at the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences at the University of Buffalo. He's the director of the endocrine course for the second year medical students at the university. So he has agreed to join us today to talk about the immune system as well as the endocrine system in dogs. So thank you, Mike, for joining us today. We're very excited to have you on board. So, Colleen, you have the first question.
Well, I am going to ask the first question based on human colds and dog colds and how they're rarely, if I have a cold, my dog rarely gets sick. Why is that?
Well, because the viruses that infect the human don't infect dogs. Most viruses that infect humans actually came from animals. For example, smallpox was derived from cowpox. Flu came from pigs and birds and such. And the fact is we're not influenced by the same viruses. It's a matter of our biology being different. Also, the manifestations of viral illness are much different in humans than in a dog. Dogs rely so much on their noses. You can imagine a virus that affected the way a dog smells would quickly kill the dogs and not really get very far, whereas a human can survive without their sense of smell. So it's really just a matter of our biology. We're, you know, it's for the same reason we can't share blood, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are also, for example, like with parasites, there are very few parasites that go between species because they're more host specific. So,
right, parasites tend to be host specific.
Right. So yeah. they don't share when most of this, like the worms that your dog gets are not the worms that we're going to get, kind of thing. And I think that's because they all adapt to a particular environment.
Yes, they've got their own life cycles,
right.
It boils down to, yes.
Okay. So
are there major differences between a human immune system and a canine immune system other than, like, what affects it, but the basic systems, you know, working? Is it pretty much the same software running the code?
Essentially, yeah. So the immune systems are very similar. They're very similar in most mammals, anyway. But the viral and parasite loads are quite different. Again, that's a matter of the viruses and the parasites, not the host immune systems. The host immune systems are adapting to whatever they're exposed to. And that has to do with our biology other than the immune system. So the immune system provides a defensive part.
Okay, so that brings me to one of the things that I think is important to understand about the immune system is why is it that vaccines work in an immune system? What actually happens with a vaccine and in the immune system?
So the immune system is really miraculous because it is set up for almost every possible infection you can get. And the numbers are almost infinite. It's really remarkable. And so you get you or your dog gets infected with a virus, and your virus is progressing and replicating and living inside you. And your immune system recognizes an invader and starts to race against it. And so you've got a race. Your immune system is going and the viruses are going. And if the viruses win, you or your dog may die. And if your immune system wins, you survive. So it's a pretty high stakes race. The idea with a vaccine is you take something that you know might be an invader, a common virus. And you either kill it through heat treatment, or you attenuate it somehow so it can't infect you. And then you inject that into the person. Your immune system says, aha, here's the invader, and it gets ready. So once it's seen an invader, it's primed against the next attack.
Okay.
So that when that real attack comes along, the immune system's not starting from scratch. It's ready to go.
Okay. So, for example, like rabies, which is such a serious right. disease. I mean, if you get rabies, you don't live.
Right.
I think there's only like two or three noted cases of people who've actually lived after getting rabies.
Right.
So your system, so they isolate the rabies. It's a virus, right?
Right.
And they give it to your dog, who's more likely to run into a raccoon or a bat or whatever that has rabies. So why do you have to have booster shots? If your body has prepared the defenses against this particular disease, why do you have to boost it? Because I'm assuming that the rabies virus itself does not change all that much, or does it?
No, I don't think rabies is one of the ones that does, although with some viruses that does happen. The main issue is that it wears out. You're primed, but that priming can be reduced over time. And rabies is so serious that you want to continue to have the immune system ready to go with fresh antigen and a fresh mode of defense. And so that, and this is empirical, so you don't know ahead of time what booster schedule you're going to need to do. You need some experience with a vaccine. But with something as devastating as rabies, you make absolutely sure and have fairly frequent vaccination. So as your immunity wears off in time, you'll be ready to go. We see this happening with latent chickenpox in humans.
Mm-hmm.
With
shingles,
yes. So as we get to be close to our 60th birthdays, you need a new vaccine, even though you've been exposed to shingles, chickenpox, because your immune system essentially forgets.
Right.
And so by boosting it, you can prevent that.
Right. And shingles is really painful, so you definitely want to do that. And also, to getting back to something like rabies, is what I find interesting about rabies is, you know, it is required by law that your dog be vaccinated against rabies. And this is a public health issue, not just for dogs, but for people as well.
Right.
And because it's incredibly important that if your dog picks it up, that's one of the few viruses that can be transferred between people and dogs. Now, I know that it used to be that you had to have an annual booster of rabies. And I know my dogs are on a 3-year booster. I don't know about yours, Colleen.
Three.
And I think that's probably because they found that they were able to carry the antigen long enough and that it was safe enough for the population, not only the canine population, but the human population as well, that you could go to a 3-year schedule.
Yeah, or it could have been a better vaccine. That's the other way to do it. But yes, and again, that's empirical. You have to do tests and wait 3 years with keeping the drugs in a controlled environment and test how well their immune systems would respond, not by actually trying to give them rabies, but by testing their immune response essentially in a dish.
Right.
And you can see, you can tell from that whether they would be able to handle infection out of 3 years. It's not a decision that I'm sure they took lightly. It was probably a lot of research to establish that.
Because it's such a devastating disease.
Yes.
Is that a titer test that you're referring to?
Yes, that would be an antibody titer test, but I promise to speak English.
Colleen accuses me of the same thing all the time. Like I wanted to say psychopharmacology in one of our episodes. She's like, you mean drugs, Julie?
Well, I know lots of vets will offer a titer test when we're debating whether or not to revaccinate an animal, particularly with older animals, where we start.
Right.
So what is the concern of over-vaccination? What does that do to an immune system?
Well, you could overprime the immune system so that it either recognizes things it shouldn't recognize. The immune system, as amazing as it is, in many ways it's kind of a blunt instrument. It has very general responses. And so having an overactive immune system can result in autoimmune diseases, for example. In older animals, pretty much everything doesn't work as well as it used to. And so you're afraid that the vaccine may actually bring on some of the symptoms of the disease that you're trying to prevent. So it's and again, it depends on the dog, and it's really a medical decision that if you've got a good vet, you should be able to work through with.
Right. Well, one of my things my vet said to me is, I'm happy to run titers for you, Julie, but what we don't know on a lot of these things is what the titer level needs to be to prove that it has immunity. We can show that it has a certain level, but is that enough to guarantee immunity? And that's the one part of the titer system that we really don't know. So he's hesitant to have me spend the money to do the titer because he doesn't know where it is on the level that says it's going to indicate that the dog truly is immune to that particular disease. And I thought that's a really interesting aspect I hadn't thought about. So we just do a 3-year boost and call it a day.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of experience. Millions of dogs have had this vaccine, and, you know, the reports of side effects are very, very low. So I think it's as safe as things like this get.
Right, right. The one thing I was going to actually – I had another question. Colleen, come up with a question because mine has gone away.
Well, my question is, we're talking about some pretty high-tech stuff going on inside our dog. So here we are just, you know, generally with our dogs. What can we do to support a healthy immune system?
So there's – if your dog is healthy in most ways, it should have a healthy immune system. I mean – there are immune systems that I'm sure there are differences within breeds and there's genetic differences, but there's nothing you can really do about anything like that. I think just generally good nutrition and, you know, all the things you do to take good care of your dog are probably the sorts of things that will help its immune system.
Okay.
I remember my question.
Okay.
Yay,
I'm so excited. It had to do with the fact that I know that in some people they can't, there are certain vaccines that some people just can't have vaccines because for whatever reason they can't tolerate them. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's the same for some dogs as well, which is why we rely on herd immunity. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about herd immunity and what that is and why that is important as well within our society.
So one of the big benefits of vaccinations, you don't have to vaccinate everybody and they don't have to be 100% immune to stop an epidemic, because a few people getting sick is a bad thing. Everybody getting sick is a horrible thing. And you can think of it as, say, a knit sweater, where the knit is the epidemic. If you start pulling threads out of it, the sweater falls apart. You don't have to pull every thread out of it.
Right.
You just have to pull enough of them out so that the sweater falls apart. And herd immunity is the same idea. So if, you know, an individual has a dog for some reason that's immunocompromised and it can't take a vaccine, everybody else vaccinating their dogs protects that dog that can't be vaccinated, because that virus isn't going to get to those other dogs and have a chance to be passed on. This is why kennels have to be so careful about these sorts of things. They'll have dogs who are immunocompromised, or maybe that they're at the tail end of the booster cycle, or elderly, or puppies, you know, they're too young for them. And having the rest of the dogs vaccinated will slow down or prevent epidemics amongst the dogs that can't be protected.
Okay. And I think that that's something that when people think in terms of, I don't want my own dog to be vaccinated, I think that we need to think about the fact that there's a responsibility that we have not only to our own dogs, but to the canine community as a whole. And that's not to say that we are suggesting that everybody go out and get their dog vaccinated every year or every month. It's just, I feel like we need to provide information about vaccines and what they do and how they work so that people can make better informed decisions when they talk to their vets about vaccinations for their dogs. So now the other thing is like, for example, I think it's leptospirosis that requires an annual vaccination. And that seems to me to be a much more unstable vaccination that some of the others can go 3-year, but I think it's lepto that needs a yearly booster. If I'm wrong, someone correct me. So why is it that some would need boosting more often than others? Is it because it's a virus that mutates, or it's the immune system is not as sensitive to it?
So a constantly mutating virus, like a human influenza virus, is very tough. And you're always guessing because you're never sure what mutations are going to pop up in a given year. I don't think a leptospirosis is something like that. I think the vaccine just, for whatever reason, is not that effective. And it's really empirical. So sometimes there are not attenuated viral strains. So viruses that are alive and active but don't make the dog sick, and you want to use something like that. A lot of times you've got to use dead viruses where you use excessive heat or something to kill the virus and then immunize with that. Well, that's not going to be as good.
It's a kind of polio, because didn't they start with the dead virus?
It was exactly the same as the evolution of the polio virus.
Right. So Okay. So some viruses, some vaccinations just are not as effective as others. And so you need to boost more often. Okay. So why is it that, for example, I got Lyme disease last year, which was really fun. Let me tell you, I had a great time with that. But they did say, oh, and by the way, if you get another tick bite, you could get that again. I'm like, I have no immunity because it's bacterial.
That's not true of all bacterial infections. It happens to be true of that one. And it's not clear to me why.
Okay.
It's not the sort of thing you can vaccinate against, because viruses have a different way of infecting organisms than bacteria do.
So bacteria you can't generally have or don't have vaccinations for?
Usually not.
Okay. Correct. All right. Well, that's kind of interesting. So one of the things... Yeah, that's what I thought was really... I was like so disappointed that I hadn't developed any immunity to Lyme disease after a month of doxycycline, which I feel like I now have an immunity to a month of doxycycline. But anyway, so that be that as it may. So you talked a little bit about autoimmune attacks, right? So what happens with an autoimmune attack? So what happens there if somebody's developed a sensitivity, a hypersensitivity to something? What is an autoimmune attack?
Well, an autoimmune attack or an autoimmune disease is where your immune system decides part of you is the enemy. And this happens, there's a lot of diseases that people don't associate as being autoimmune diseases that are.
Isn't lupus one of them?
Lupus is an autoimmune disease. It doesn't involve the endocrine system, but type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune attack on the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. Hashimoto's thyroiditis, the most common form of hypothyroidism, is an autoimmune attack on the thyroid gland. Graves' disease is a different kind of autoimmune attack on the thyroid gland. Addison's disease, which is a form of hypocortisolism in the adrenal glands. I'm not speaking English anymore.
I think both Graves and Addison are fairly common in dogs, right?
I think they are, yes. And I know that the dogs also suffer, from hypothyroidism as well. That's fairly common. Yeah.
So,
but I've never heard it called Hashimoto's with dogs.
No,
I have fibromyalgia. Do we think dogs get fibromyalgia?
It would really be hard to tell, because you can't really be diagnosed with fibromyalgia unless somebody describes it to their physician. And that's how the physician decides you have fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
I don't know, unless you have a really smart dog, I don't know how you get them across.
Boy, that dog is cranky. Oh, yeah, I know why. That's how it manifested in Colleen. Everything hurt, and she was cranky. Oh!
That's right. So, Zuzu, you are being awfully cranky today. So autoimmune, that's sort of the crossover between then the immune system and the endocrine system is when this autoimmune disease attacks an endocrine gland. Right. So can we talk a little bit about the endocrine system?
Sure.
Okay.
So the endocrine system, it's not actually one discrete system. So the endocrine system is the part of your body that's responsible for producing hormones. And hormones are chemicals that course through your bloodstream that regulate many of your functions over day to day and over your lifetime. And there's not really much that holds them together. So, for example, hormones regulate the amount of sugar in the bloodstream. They regulate the amount of calcium, potassium, sodium in the bloodstream. They, of course, drive reproduction. You can't have pregnancy or puberty or lactation without hormones. They also are involved in day-to-day maintenance. Like, for example, thyroid hormones do that. And they're involved in managing your response to external stresses. And that's what hormones like cortisol and adrenaline do. So there's not really much that holds it together. That's what makes it a complicated system to study. And in fact, that's how I ended up teaching it, is because nobody else wanted to do it, because it's a hard thing to deal with.
Well, it's also, Mike was telling me, it's one of the last things that they talk about in medical school, because they talk about all the other systems first, because this is the hardest. So you need to understand how the other ones are working, because the endocrine system, of course, has a direct effect on so many of the other systems as well. You have hormones that affect, your blood sugar. They have hormones that affect your reproduction. Hormones affect, basically sort of all parts of your body. And so it's not, in some ways, as closed a system as like the digestive tract. or, you know, that has a not that you, you.
No, digestion is easy to teach. You start at the mouth and you go just right through. It's very linear.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You have nothing like that in the endocrine system.
Okay. So, for example, it seems to me then that these would be much harder things to diagnose.
Yes.
Because it's not straightforward.
Right. So endocrine diseases are hard to diagnose. And most vets, unless the symptoms are just really obvious, I think for most vets, it's probably the last thing they look for. It's not very common. Most of them are not very common in the total scheme of and again, diagnosis is tricky. What's good about endocrine diseases is that once your vet suspects one, the testing's not that tough. You can test blood levels of hormones, which aren't terrifically expensive. They're common tests, and they're easily interpretable. And the other good thing is most of the time they're treatable.
Okay.
So that's because the endocrine disease, because those are things that are floating around your bloodstream, most of them have been known about for a long time. There's lots of ways to supplement them and reduce them, and so treatments tend to be available for these things.
Well, one of the things that Mike told me is that, was it the most prescribed drug is levothyroxine
among humans,
yeah. Which is the Synthroid.
Yeah, there's 30 million prescriptions a month. That's
a month.
More than 10% of the U.S. adult population
really? Is on
yes.
Yeah, on thyroid meds.
Wow.
I'm one. So yeah,
I had no idea.
I know a lot of people who take thyroid meds. Just among my experience, the fair number of people who did it, but I had no idea it was 30 million prescriptions a month. Amazing.
So why do you think that is, Mike? I mean, we're veering a little bit into human stuff here, but the idea that if we have this system that's designed to keep our body functioning in all the different hormone ways, why would it be that such a large percentage of a population is skewed into needing a little extra help?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's hard to say whether thyroid disease is becoming more common, and some people claim it is, or whether we're better at diagnosing it mm-hmm. and have treatment for it so we understand it better. And there's no good way to answer that question. It's just become a very common feature of clinical practice. It's not something like 12 to 15% of the U.S. adult population has type 2 diabetes. We know why that's happening. Okay? And most of the most common endocrine drugs are anti-diabetes drugs that you hear about. So that one's easily understandable. But the thyroid disease is really hard to figure why it's become so common.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a combination of the two.
It could be.
Sometimes I find that the answers to these things are seldom one particular
right.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, why is obesity on the rise in the United States? I don't think it's because we're all sitting around watching, Breaking Bad and eating potato chips. I think that there are probably other things involved in that. So the endocrine system,
mm-hmm.
For example, I think that there you gave me a really interesting example of what the endocrine system regulates. If you want to talk about
okay.
the chihuahuas, that's really interesting.
Okay. So anybody who studies biology and thinks about dogs at all, you take the Venn diagram biologists and physiologists and people who spent their lives around dogs. And you start to think in dogs this way. And, you don't necessarily have to have a PhD to look at a Chihuahua or a Pomeranian and compare them to a Great Dane and think, really? Those are the same animal?
Mm-hmm.
And they are. So one of the things the endocrine system is well known for doing is it regulates growth. And it regulates growth in sort of a broad sense. So growth isn't just a matter of getting taller, but growth is a matter of maintaining your tissue mass. Okay, and during puberty, of course, that gets bigger. Ideally, it doesn't get much bigger after puberty, but it still has to be maintained. And the hormone responsible for that comes from the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is a little gland at the base of your brain. It's about the size of the tip of your little finger, and it's directly behind the tip of your nose. So it goes straight back. And from there, one of the hormones, it secretes 8 separate hormones. One of the hormones is called growth hormone. And for years and years, thought, aha, growth hormone is what makes people grow. And it turns out, or for dogs or anything, it turns out it's not growth hormone. The growth hormone turns on another hormone called insulin-like growth factor 1. There is a protein that is on all cells. It's called a receptor for insulin-like growth factor 1, or IGF-1. its receptor is a big protein. It has maybe 800 individual amino acids. If you change just two of those amino acids, and you'd never guess which two just by looking at it, you get the difference in height between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane. And there's no other animal that works like that. It's really unusual to dogs.
Huh. So it's just it's all the endocrine system.
Yes.
Whether you have a Chihuahua or you have a Great Dane.
But a tiny, tiny difference in the endocrine system. If you measure the levels of growth hormone and stuff within a Chihuahua and a Great Dane as they're going through puberty, you wouldn't see the difference. It's just in the way that the cells within the bones of a Chihuahua and a Great Dane react to it that's different.
That's interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
This is complete,
weird, but interesting.
It is.
I mean, weird, but interesting on the show.
It is deeply weird. Okay. I mean, humans, there are 200 different genetic differences that can determine the difference in adult height within humans. This is aside from the differences that tend to make men taller than most women. Right?
Uh-huh.
Of those 200 differences, none of them account for more than about a quarter of an inch.
Huh.
Okay, at the most extreme. But yet dogs, you have this one sort of choke point that seems to determine everything. It's a really interesting difference.
That is a very interesting difference. So it's not like in humans there's just a gene for height. There's 200.
At least
to determine your height. Whereas in the Chihuahua versus a Great Dane, it's the difference of two amino acids in a receptor cell.
Yeah, a difference of much less than 1%.
Wow. That is really cool.
That is really cool.
So that's okay. That's just mind-boggling is what that really is. So my question is going back to sort of growth. Now we have this growth hormone that mm-hmm. triggers the hormone that actually
right.
causes the growth. What turns it off? What is it that suddenly goes, okay, we're done. We are going to stop growing now.
Okay, so nothing really turns it off. It's a matter of more and less, right? And we do stop growing, and that's because the cells in the bones that grow, that divide to make bones longer, are sensitive to reproductive hormones, especially estrogen. Right? And so that big rush of estrogen you start to get later in puberty takes those cells and says, don't divide anymore. It's what's known as closing the growth plates.
Okay. Right?
And when you have that big rush of reproductive hormones, at that point, you can't get any taller.
Okay. Is there any way to reopen growth plates?
No.
So even if you were to add in not the growth hormone, but the hormone that it triggers.
By that time, it's too late.
It's too late. Once those
plates are lost, the potential is gone.
The potential. Okay. Okay. So what happens then to like, and this is going to, I'm veering way off now, Colleen, so you can bring me back at any point.
We do that.
Yeah. So what happens to weightlifters and bodybuilders who take these growth hormones to really boost themselves up, these steroids and stuff, right,
So steroids and growth hormones aren't the same thing.
Okay.
So what they call steroids are what endocrinologists call androgens or androgenic receptor antagonists, but that's not in English. And those are variations of testosterone. And testosterone will cause muscle to build, but it won't actually make you any taller.
Okay.
Hopefully most of these bodybuilders are well beyond puberty when they start to take these things. Growth hormones do much the same thing. They will help you build muscle.
Okay.
And that's why they take them. It is worth considering there is a population of humans, they're called laryngeals, and they have mutations in the receptors for growth hormone, in the way growth hormone interacts with their cells. They're native to Ecuador, the laryngeals, right?
Okay.
And they're short. But cancer and diabetes are unknown to them. They live a very long time, and they never get cancer, and they never get diabetes. So people ought to think a little bit before abusing growth hormones.
Huh.
Their cost.
There is a
interesting.
That is interesting. And so we have growth hormones and we have steroids. And mm-hmm. and which brings me to the use. I mean, some people get really anxious about the use of steroids with their dogs, the use of prednisone or something to mm-hmm. relieve pain or stiffness or whatever. And my vet said, you know, it's a miracle drug, and every dog should have the opportunity to use it if need be, but it needs to be used with caution. So you want to talk a little bit about what happens with steroids. Okay. and why it is you need to use them with caution.
Right. So the first thing about steroids that's important to understand is that based on tiny differences in the chemistry of a steroid, it can do something completely different. So you've got steroids involved in reproduction. You've got the testosterone and estrogen. And you've got steroids involved in controlling stress responses, like inflammation. Okay. And those are based on the steroid hormone cortisol. They're very different. And there's no cross-reactivity. So when you hear steroids, it's important to understand there are different kinds of steroids. Mm-hmm. And the kind of pop culture names for them may not be appropriate. So prednisone is a chemical it's a chemical similar to a hormone called cortisol, which helps control stress response. So that, and stress response is normal. So we think of, people oftentimes think of, well, the endocrine system is what causes stress. But it's not really what causes stress. It's what controls stress. So, and the stresses can take a lot of forms. It can be an illness where you've got an immune system that's just going crazy and attacking things and can get out of hand. You can get runaway inflammation. A lot of people think this is partially what's going on in fibromyalgia. You can get, stresses can be something simple, like, you know, the mailman is a threat. And that sets off the endocrine response, and the dog has a stress, and it responds by barking, and its epinephrine levels go up, its adrenaline levels go up, and they go back down, and that's all perfectly normal. In fact, it's healthy. You need some stress.
The mailman doesn't feel that way.
Well, but the mailman has the same stress response. It's really sort of a nice thing. And some mailmen do it. Eventually, mailmen just learn to ignore it, I'm sure. But, you know, but if a mailman comes every day, stress response can go up and stay up, and that can be kind of a bad thing. You know, okay. If you have, say, you know, 20 minutes, you get a lot of Amazon things, you can really drive your car. So sometimes your endocrine system can't effectively control the immune response. The immune response is just too much for it. And so you supplement it with prednisone. Okay? And prednisone is a great drug. It really is a miracle drug. It has a lot of effects. So its major effect in most cases will be to reduce inflammation. So, and inflammation can cause pain. A lot of times it doesn't seem to have a medical or physiological point to it. It just is causing suffering. And prednisone is very effective at taking this away. It also tends to promote a sense of well-being and has a lot of other beneficial effects. Now, there is a cost to this. When you give a dog, or a person for that matter, prednisone, you are giving it at a higher dose than they naturally make. That's why you had to give it in the first place. And what you do is that the body's control systems says, oh man, there's a lot of cortisol here. I've got to make less. And so it shuts down your adrenal gland's ability to make its own cortisol.
Okay? I see.
And so the dog takes prednisone for a period of weeks. And then if you've ever done that, you'll say 3 pills a day, and then it'll be 2 pills a day for a week, and then 1 pill, and then half a pill. He'll have you step down. So what you're doing is you're gradually reducing the artificial cortisol. And the dog's pituitary gland says, well, that cortisol is going down a little bit. Better crank it up and make a little more and give it some time, because it can't just do it in a minute. It takes days for this to happen. Okay? Whereas if people say, well, you know, the dog seems fine, I'm just going to stop giving him these pills because I'm worried about steroids. Well, now all of a sudden the dog's making no cortisol at all because you caught the pituitary by surprise, saying, wait a minute, we've got to make more cortisol, but you just can't turn that right on. It takes a few days to occur. At that point, you're leaving the dog open to all sorts of terrible things. It has no physiological ability to handle stresses. So if another infection, say, comes along, you've got a big immune response, the dog's a sitting duck for all sorts of terrible side effects because it doesn't have its endocrine system in place to handle them normally.
Okay.
It's really helpful. I have never heard it explained that way before, but that makes tremendous sense. And I've been guilty of, like, not giving the last couple of days of prednisone.
Yes.
Oh,
sorry, Edzo. But yeah, I mean, it was a week or 10 days or something, and you know, he was so much better, and I thought, oh, he's good enough. We can, you know, we had been tapering, but we had not gotten down to the very end, and now I realize that there was a risk to that, but I was thinking of it more from the aspect of pain as opposed to the endocrine effects of it. So thank you for that. The major dose of guilt I've just had through my body I'm not thrilled about, but my dog will be happy if ever he needs prednisone again that I have more knowledge.
Well, the other thing is I found too is that prednisone was really helpful for end-of-life comfort for two of my dogs, for both for Rebel, who had myelin degeneration, which means in English he had a neural disease. The mylar sheath, which is how do I explain
it? That's English?
It's the coating around nerve cells that acts much like the insulation of a wire.
Okay. The coating on the nerves of his spinal cord were deteriorating, and that always goes posterior from the tail to the head. And the prednisone that he was on for the 3 weeks between diagnosis and the point where we needed to put him down gave him a quality of life he would never have had otherwise. It reduced the inflammation so he was able to walk for that first week. He was comfortable enough so that we could wait for Ellie to get home from college to say goodbye to her dog. And he could sit in the living room and eat popcorn while we put the Christmas tree up. So it gave him a quality of life up until the very end. And I was really grateful for that. And the same thing for Buckley when we realized that his cancer had come back. And that we were not going to be able to save him, but we were able to keep him very comfortable for the last 2 to 3 weeks of his life by having him on a daily course of prednisone that we didn't drop down because we knew that it wasn't going to be necessary. So I think that not only is it important for dogs who have individual issues that we have to take care of and they have a life ahead of them, but it's also important to understand it can really provide for a quality of life at the end that would not be there otherwise. So that was a great explanation, and thank you very much for that.
Yeah, that was really helpful.
Do we have anything else we need to discuss about the immune system or the endocrine system that you think family dog owners need to know?
Well, I have one question. It's a little off topic from where we've been, but it's with the idea of the endocrine system shooting out the cortisol or the adrenaline, you know, like, oh my gosh, there's a problem. From the aspect, again, of just your general pet owner, what are the things that we can do to help speed the effects of reducing the level of adrenaline in a revved up, excited, aroused dog?
There's nothing you can do, really. I mean, so adrenaline actually clears from the bloodstream very quickly. If you think of, you know, a thunderclap going off, I actually, in my classes, I'm known for picking up a folding chair and throwing it across the room and yelling at the students that we're going to have a pop quiz and they're all terrible students and stuff. And you just see the horror on their faces. And then I tell them, you know, check your pulse. And it's always going rapidly and feel how quickly it goes down. So it revs up very quickly. You know, that when you know, I have a Jack Russell Terrier, I know how quickly this can happen. But, you know, the man hits the door and it's less than, a, you know, it seems like it's a second or two. But it goes away really quickly. It's part of the dog's natural physiological response. And it starts in their central nervous system. It starts in their brain. And as soon as they perceive that whatever's happening is no longer a threat, they'll calm down. There's no real way to chemically manipulate it that's really desirable.
Okay, but can it have a residual effect? Because it seems to me that some dogs who have, they will get aroused when playing, and then they get so aroused they spill over into aggression, right? It seems like it takes them almost 24 hours to come completely down. Does adrenaline have a residual effect?
No, but it can be the effect of chronically high stress. So. Adrenaline is a fast stress response, and it's our way of handling, or dog's way of handling immediate stress. So a bear is attacking, or a big dog is out there, it's going to attack. And so that's your adrenaline response. You're living in a neighborhood full of big dogs, and every time you go out for a walk, there's big dogs that are going to get you. That would be more of a cortisol thing. It's slow, it's long term. One of cortisol's effects is to allow the dog to make more adrenaline. So if a dog's constantly stressed, then they're going to be more hair trigger. So, but this all has its origins in behavior, right? Because these things, the big dog may never attack. So it's perception. And if you think about it in biology, it has to be that way. You can't wait to get attacked by a lion to know that the lion's dangerous. you have to have some sense that that's going on first. And so by being able to anticipate that, you ramp up stress system ready to handle that attack, to be ready to move quickly, to supply extra blood sugar, to get your immune response ready to go, has all these effects. And it dampens your reproductive system. It can do a lot of things. So all these effects to handle this danger. Right? So if you've got the dog, but it's behavior. It doesn't have to actually be a danger. It just has to be the perception of danger. So it goes back to, you know, the dog, the sort of old-fashioned stuff you guys talk about, is that the dog's environment, if it feels stressed and threatened and comfortable and safe, is really the only reasonable way to control these things.
Right, and then what happens is if a dog has, and I see, and I'm sure you do too, Colleen, our smaller dogs are generally more reactive to, you know, big dogs and big things. So then what happens is not only do we have this perception, but then what happens if I actually am attacked, then things are just, the dog is ramped up even more all the time because the perception has come true.
Right.
And right. That makes things even more difficult. I was thinking about a client of mine that his dog was a miniature schnauzer mix thing, mm-hmm. and it was maybe 25 pounds. So he's not a tiny dog, but not a big dog either. They were leaving the dog park when a dog just came around the corner out of the blue and just nailed him. Mm-hmm. And he had a big gash in his side and so on and so forth. And from that point on, this dog was terrified. Well, you could see the trauma increase. Not only was he was for a while, he was terrified of big black dogs. And then he just became terrified of dogs. And it took a long time for us to counter condition and desensitize him to the point where he could even go for a walk in his neighborhood without being completely, you know, freaked out. So his perception and his reality, unfortunately, hit each other head on. So
right, and it's now known that cortisol, especially when you're young, so if traumas that happen during puppyhood or even in to a mother in utero, when cortisol levels are very high, it can change the way the DNA in the dog's brain works.
Yep.
In a way that almost never reverses. So you can never really take that stuff away. All you can do is kind of learn to manage it.
Right. And I think about, I mean, and there are times in a dog's developmental phases where it's more prone to a fear response than others. And if mm-hmm. you have something happen during one of those fear phases, then the effects of that particular incident are going to be much higher and has mm-hmm. that single event learning. And I've used this example before of Hudson, our golden retriever, who was, I don't know, somewhere around 5-6 months, when a gate, baby gate, fell down behind him, crashed to the ground, didn't hit him, but startled the bejeebers out of him until the day he died. He was, you know, Gates. It doesn't matter how much cheese we associated with Gates or Emma, they are retrievers. And they are very dangerous things. And it was great because he wouldn't go every time. I just had to lean the gate and I could keep Hudson in a room. But it was something we could never completely get him. I mean, to go past a gate took everything he had, you know, and like a block of cheese. So...
And there's a flip side to stress management, especially when dogs are young. You know, you talk about socializing puppies by exposing them to other dogs. But this has got to be stressful for the puppy.
Yes.
But that's a good thing. So you can't just take a puppy and protect them from all stress, because that has effects on brain chemistry that are permanent as well. And the trick is to have the right amount of stress. And mm-hmm. this is true in puppies and humans and everything. You can't live without stress. You absolutely need stress to have normal brain development, but too much is a problem. And so, you know, even though the socialization process, you know, if you're a little concerned about big dogs and you're a puppy, everything is a big dog. But they still kind of have to go through it to have their brains develop in a normal way and be able to handle these levels of stresses.
Good point. But you're right, it's finding that balance between too little and too much and what's just right. Yeah. And you know what? You're going to err sometimes. But in general, if you get it right and have your dog have a lot of different experiences, then it's the quantity of experiences will also help to regulate yeah. the quality of any individual experience. If you've only had 5 experiences with, you know, people or dogs by the time you're 4 months of age, you don't have a lot of things to draw back on. But if you've met 100 people and 25 dogs, then you have a lot more experiences and the bad ones are going to be modulated a little bit more. So, well, thank you, Mike. I think that was terrific. I think I understand the immune system and the endocrine system a whole lot more. And So thank you. That was very great. And we'll see you all next time on Your Family Dog.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.